Hello and welcome to the third Music Business Worldwide podcast, once again supported by CI, experts in digital music delivery, and a trusted partner for many of the biggest independent labels, aggregators and distributors in the world. Once again, we're joined by a titan of the global music industry, a gentleman who co-founded one of the most iconic labels and publishers that the world has ever seen and is still actively involved in the music industry. He's worked with artists from Blondie to Jethro Tull, Procol Harum, Billy Idol and Spandau Ballet, and he wrote a fantastic autobiography that came out last year, one way or another. That gentleman is Chris Wright. Chris, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
I'm going to ask lots about your career and lots about the time at Chrysalis and how that grew. But before we get there, I said that you were active in the music industry these days. You're working with BMG. Is that correct?
Well, yes, I'm still officially working with BMG. But in actual fact, I think my main role with BMG has been sort of declining over the last sort of year or so. I was actively involved when they bought the company for a few years, and I'm now still around if they want me, but I think they're almost in charge of their own ship now, and you know they don't need the pilot to help them navigate it.
But you still have a passion or an interest to be in the industry.
I'm involved in a few startup operations that are music and music related, and also you know one or two things that are not music related, like TV production, which was a part of what I did before with Chrysalis. There are things happening which could see me involved again in the music business in a much more serious way than I have been for the last year or two. But I can't announce anything on that yet. But, you know, I think it's a question of watch this space.
Yep. You'll be able to read about it on Music Business Worldwide, of course.
You will if it happens the way it could well happen.
How do you rate the health of the modern music business, and particularly the record business and how it's being impacted by streaming?
Obviously, everything has changed dramatically over the last sort of 10 years or so, maybe 10, 15 years. It's a very different business now than it ever was. Obviously, the main thing really is the change from between the position where you sold music and people paid a lot of money for it to the point that people could get it for free, and then you had to actually get a price point on the cost of people acquiring music to the point that they were quite happy to pay that. If it's a question of free or £10, well, free is very attractive. If it's free or 50p or something like that, then obviously the differential isn't so great. And now we've migrated to streaming, and it's a very different world where you don't even need to own anything. If you want to hear something, you just press a button on whatever you know equipment you've got, and you hear it as many times as you want to, whenever you want. It's slightly foreign to someone that grew up in the era that I grew up in, and obviously people pay very little for each stream. But the interest in music is as great, if not greater, than ever. And every little tiny stream makes a very, very infinitesimally small amount of money for everyone involved. But because there is so much of it, and the interest is so great, that once the industry has come to terms with that's what they have to deal with, which seems to either have happened or is certainly happening, then it becomes a sustainable business model. A slightly different model, but at least a sustainable business model, and that's what people are concentrating on.
I wanted to ask about the majors, particularly the major labels. You've been watching that develop, the acquisition of EMI, which of course was involved in acquiring part of Chrysalis at one stage. Twofold question, really. What do you think of the amount of power and market share that they currently hold? And also, can a company with quarterly targets ever truly nurture an artist?
Well, dealing with the second question first, I do think it is very difficult for a publicly owned corporation that has got to come up with quarterly targets and make numbers which are dictated to them by investment analysts and so forth. And I've been there, don't forget, even as an independent company, I was a publicly quoted company. It does make it very difficult because you don't have that luxury to be able to go out and sign an artist that you really believe in and just think, you know, what the hell, we're going to stick with this artist. It might take 2 or 3 years for them to make it, maybe even longer. But if we believe in someone, then we don't care that the numbers don't look good for the first, you know, couple of years. I think it is a huge problem for the industry. that together with the fact that the return on investment in general isn't what it used to be, that a major now going out and signing somebody just, you know, would be very nervous about having that much money stacked up on somebody that, you know, ultimately may or may not make it, even if you really believe in them. And I don't think it's not a strange thing that most of the major artists seem to have been broken by independents over the years, because independents and privately owned companies and so forth don't have that pressure on them. And in terms of today, yes, of course, the majors have incredible power. It, to the extent that it's not even easy for independents to flourish in that environment, and certainly wouldn't be were it not for what the internet brings to the equation. But the other thing also is that it's so easy now for people to make money out of artists that aren't artists, just because they got their name in the paper or because they're on a TV talent show or something like that. So you don't have to worry about investing dollars and pounds in groups and artists that could become the superstars of, you know, 10 years' time, that whose music we're going to be listening to when we're old and grey like me, because it's just so easy to put out an X Factor type artist. You sell a ton of records in the first year or two, and if they're not around in 5 years' time, who cares? But it's just an easier fix. But because of that, I think the long-term artists aren't being developed, not to the extent that they were. And, you know, thank heavens we've got people like Martin Mills and so forth and other independent labels that are able to buck against that particular trend.
Talking of independence, I mean, the last person on the podcast was Daniel Glass, who talked in very complimentary terms about the culture of Chrysalis and what that did for him and his A&R vision, I suppose. How would you define what you built, the culture at Chrysalis as a music company? What identified what you and Terry created, as opposed to an island or a 4AD or a Rough Trade at the time?
Well, in those days, although we were all small independents, as it were, in a big global sea, we all had our own distinctly different identities. And if you looked at the Chrysalis label and bought a Chrysalis artist, you would expect it had a certain feel to it, and that would be a different kind of feel possibly to Island or Virgin or the other major competitors at that time. In terms of the artists we signed, we always looked for artists that were different, that were special, that we felt had a long-term career, that were doing something innovative musically, and they were all in a certain genre, originally of, you know, blues-based rock, and then, you know, a little bit of, as we moved into progressive rock and so forth, through to, you know, punk, but not hardcore punk, softcore punk, and then more interesting, even in the, you know, the new romantic era. You know, we were always looking for a group that had, you know, something very, very different. I always used to say to people when we looked at someone, can you see them on stage at Madison Square Garden? If you couldn't see them on stage at Madison Square Garden or a big venue like that, then, you know, they didn't have that ultimate potential that we wanted from someone. And I think, you know, we were very successful in being able to do that. It did mean that a lot of artists that might have signed to us didn't sign to us. But once, in those days, the label had an identity, the artists that felt they were right on that label would gravitate towards you, and they would want to be with you because they would want a little bit of that magic to rub off onto them, so that when their record came out, it was on Chrysalis and people were going to take more notice of it. And that was a key thing. But of course, it's all very different now and you don't have that. But, you know, that's what happened, and the same thing with Island and Virgin and our other major competitors. You knew that that record had a certain something which made it different from what you might get somewhere else.
Seeing you talk with such passion about what Chrysalis meant and obviously what Island meant, both have been sold into bigger companies. I mean, in the case of Chrysalis, very sadly, it's the recorded business and writing thing kind of got pulled apart with the EMI acquisition, then the Parlophone label group sell off to Warner. Do you ever regret that you sold that iconic logo and company?
I mean, that the Chrysalis record sale took place in, I think, about 1988, 89, something like that. We ran into some serious financial problems, especially in America. And we were running short of cash. I mean, I think we gravitated from an era when we had a pretty solid flow of product to a point when we had a shortage of product, and we had huge overheads, and we had some issues with the health of some of our artists, like especially Blondie. Billy Idol had some problems, mm-hmm. and then a motorbike accident, and we ran into cash flow problems. And the label was originally not sold, but went into a joint venture with EMI, which was supposed to last for 10 years. But, of course, you know, it's very difficult when you've got one huge partner and a smaller partner. And EMI did end up buying the whole of the label. I did, at the time that I sold the label, I put a clause in the contract saying that every single artist that was on the Chrysalis label had to appear on the Chrysalis label in perpetuity. And that clause is still there in that agreement. It's cast in stone. What's happened since has been quite strange, because it was with EMI, it was upheld, that particular situation. But when the deal with Universal was done, Universal managed to cherry pick the artists that were signed to the US company, or catalogue signed to the US company, and keep that, because that was outside the jurisdiction of the European Commission. Mm-hmm. And so what passed over to Warner was only a part of the Chrysalis label, and now we have this the Warner sell-off situation as well, where they have to divest of certain assets. And it is quite upsetting, really, that a label that was iconic and should have been kept together, and the artists should have been kept together on the label, has been allowed to dissipate to the extent that it has. And really, from a legal standpoint, it should not be happening. Mm. Do I regret selling it? I mean, yes, but I mean, you can't, you know, it's hard to regret. We sold the Chrysalis label, not ultimately because we wanted to, but because we had gone into a 10-year joint venture, which was unsustainable, and we had no alternative. In terms of regretting it, no, in a way, because after the label went, you know, I was able to do other things. I created a very large television production company, a very large radio station group. I did things that I wouldn't have been able to do otherwise. You know, I developed the music publishing company, and we created a new label with Echo, which was in itself quite successful, yeah. as well. And I think the Chrysalis that was reborn out of that in the mid-90s through to the, you know, to the mid-noughties, so to speak, was probably as exciting a time as the early 70s for me in what we achieved, or even maybe more exciting. No, let's just say as exciting. There were two hugely defining moments, the creation of the label in the early mid-70s and what we did with developing the company into other areas and recreating on the music side in the 90s. So the second one, that wouldn't have happened had I been actively still involved in running the record label.
What was your proudest moment, do you think, in all of that time at Chrysalis, both in the publishing side and the record side? What really stands out?
There are lots of proud moments. I mean, every artist that you signed from scratch and worked with and developed that became successful is a really proud moment, because you know you feel that you've been part of creating something which you know is important. I mean, the feeling of getting off a plane in a, you know, Timbuktu or anywhere in the world and jumping in a taxi and the radio is playing one of the records that you helped create, that you helped develop that artist, to get to the point that that's happening is a very special moment. But as I said, I mean, I think that for me, the early 70s and everything happened, late 60s even. I mean, going to America with 10 years after in mid 68, I mean, it was a very, very, very special time, and everything that followed on after that. That was, you know, for me, if I could relive 6 months of my life, you know, and have it all over again, it would be then. And of course, then I didn't have two pennies to rub together, but that didn't matter. You know, we were out there pioneering, and, you know, you could feel everything developing, you know, every second of the day.
And I'm guessing you didn't get that much sleep during that period either.
You didn't get a lot of sleep, no. You know, some days on tour in those days, we'd be on three or four plane flights in one day. I remember, you know, with 10 years after, once on, it was a Thanksgiving day, we did Vancouver on the Wednesday night, and we were doing El Paso, Texas on the Thursday night. And we had 4 plane flights: Vancouver to Seattle, Seattle, Denver, Denver, Albuquerque, Albuquerque, El Paso, 4 turkey dinners, 4 flights, 1 gig. But that's what you had to put up with.
I've asked this for the last 2 podcast guests, and I'll ask it of you as well. What stands out as a regret or perhaps a mistake, and what did you learn from it?
It's hard to regret things. I mean, you know, there are artists you wish you'd signed that you didn't sign, and artists you have signed that you wish you hadn't signed. I mean, you know, in terms of regrets, it's unfortunate that the label went in the way it did. That is a regret, isn't it? It's unfortunate even that in 2011 that the company, you know, which at the time was essentially Music, Chrysalis Music and the Echo label, that went. It wasn't ideal, but we were a public company, and we had institutional shareholders, and, you know, institutional shareholders are really only interested in making profits on their shares, and we were backed against the wall. So, of course, I regret that too. There are other things that one might regret, but it's hard. You've got to think forward, not backwards. You've got to think about tomorrow, not yesterday.
This is a slightly strange question. Someone suggested I ask this of guests recently, and I think it may elicit some interesting insight into your career. Have you ever felt betrayed professionally?
Well, once or twice, yes. But in all honesty, I think I'd rather not go there. I mean, I alluded to, you know, 1 or 2 things in my book, which was heavily censored by the lawyers before it came out as well. But I mean, there are times when, you know, I do feel that, you know, maybe people didn't behave the way that I would have expected. I come from a pretty old school in terms of, you know, my professional ethics, and unfortunately, you know, I'm a bit of a dinosaur in that respect, but, you know, I behave in a certain honourable way. My word is my word. I don't say yes until I mean yes. And I don't do something which might hurt someone else without first asking them if they would mind me doing it.
Having read the book, obviously you signed and developed so many iconic artists. Some of them I mentioned before, Blondie and Procol Harum too, that just immediately stand out to me. But you occasionally let artists slip through the net, and the one that perhaps stands out to me the most is David Bowie. I was wondering if you could tell the story of how he came to get noticed.
It was very simple. We started a music publishing company, Art of Chrysalis Music, and the guy we hired to run it, Bob Grace, wanted to sign David Bowie as a songwriter. David Bowie had the Space Oddity record, and then nothing much after that. He did have a reputation after that as being a pop star, and even to some extent maybe a one-hit wonder. So he didn't quite fit into what, you know, we saw as being what a Chrysalis artist would be. But we did sign him to the music publishing company. And, of course, he was developing as an artist anyway. He made a record. He made Hunky Dory. I was over in America at the time. We were in the pole position to pick up his recording rights and the Hunky Dory album. We had the Chrysalis label up and running by then. And Terry, my ex-partner, listened to it, and it didn't grab him. And it was as simple as that. And we let it go elsewhere. And I must admit, and I mean, you know, these things happen. I did come back from the States, listened to it myself, and I thought, wow, I really like this. I think, you know, you might have made a mistake. But look, we all make mistakes. I've turned down plenty of people as well. You know, we turned down Dire Straits. I heard the Dire Straits album. I couldn't believe we'd turned it down, because I'm a bit of a guitar freak anyway, and there's some beautiful guitar playing on the first Dire Straits album. And I said, absolutely cannot believe it. I was at a meeting where we listened to that and we turned it down. And I went through all of the minutes, all of the A&R meetings, and I could actually prove that it was a meeting that I had not been present, and that the Chris Briggs, who was the A&R guy at the time, said that he'd been to see them, and he said they were very, very good, but very, very boring. And that was in the minutes. So we let them go too. I could have signed Rod Stewart and the Faces when they started, but Alvin Lee with 10 Years After was very concerned that, you know, he knew them well, they were all mates, he felt it might, you know, upset his relationship with me, so in deference to him I didn't. There's lots of situations, but by the same token, you know, what about the ones that you thought you might sign, that it was a £1 million deal and so forth, and very hot artist, everybody's trying to sign them, and at the last minute you say no, and they go and sign with someone else, and we can't remember their names because we've never heard of them.
Well, you win some and you lose some, and you've won plenty, I think, when you look at your scorecard.
If you win more than you lose, then you're ahead of the game.
And then final question, which again I ask of all guests, something of a motif of the podcast, but I wanted to know which executives, dead or alive, have you most respected in the music business? And are there any younger execs now that particularly impress you?
Well, first of all, I mean, at Chrysalis, you know, we did have, through our, you know, cadre of executives, a lot of young people that joined the company and have gone on to become very, very successful. And I really pride myself on the fact that people like Daniel Glass, Ron Fair, Simon Fuller is another one, Jeff Aldridge, Pete Edge, and so forth. I'm sure I'm missing other people as well that have had stellar careers in the industry and are doing incredible things. Came to Chrysalis, you know, when they were absolutely like, you know, right off the street, you know, new people, and that they must have learnt something from the way that I, you know, ran the company and the way that we operated to be able to go on and do as well as they're doing. And I take my hat off to all of them, you know, many of whom have been much more successful than I've been. So, I mean, I think if the student learns from the master and becomes better than the master, I think there's some Chinese proverb about that, I forgot what it is, Confucius, he say, or something like that, then I think then that's, you've done something very, very well. In terms of people in the industry, I mean, you know, the people I learnt from in the past were the people of my generation, you know, people like a Chris Blackwell and how he worked with his artists in management, Peter Grant, who managed Led Zeppelin, amongst other people, and what he did in terms of a manager and his commitment. I learned an awful lot from Peter. We worked in the same building. He took me under his wing, and I think I owe Peter an awful lot. As I say, Chris Blackwell, Mo Austin at Warner and Armit, and his brother Nesui Ertegun at Atlantic. I learned a lot from them as well. Or someone like a Freddie Beanstock in music publishing. These people, most of whom aren't around, some still are, of course, but most aren't. They're the people that I really learn from, and that the people that I really respect more than anybody else, because I think they did some marvelous things. They were very genuinely involved with their artists. They were always honest, decent, honourable people, where the talent came first, where the creativity was the key, and I think that's great. I learnt an awful lot actually from a guy called Don Reed that I worked with in Manchester, who brought us what became Jethro Tull, because, you know, working as an agent in Manchester in 1966, he was probably the first person I worked with that really thought in terms of, you know, developing artists and what was best for the artist rather than what's best for the business. So there's been a lot, you know, and in terms of people today, I mean, it's hardly fair to say Martin Mills is a, you know, is a young person, because he's almost as old as me now, but he came along a little later. He's still going, and what a fantastic job he's done. I wish I could pinpoint 25 and 30 year olds that are going to be the new Martin Mills or Daniel Glass or whatever, but sadly, you know, my involvement with the industry is a little too peripheral now to be able to really seriously be able to identify those, although if I do get, you know, a little bit more involved in the course of the next few months, then maybe we'll find someone.
Well, it's nice to leave it on an intriguing note. Chris, it's been, genuinely been an honour and a pleasure to have you on the podcast, so thank you for coming on.
Well, it's been great. I'm very, very welcome to be here.
Thank you. Once again, I'd like to say thank you to our supporter, CI, and our host at Tune Tribe Entertainment Group, and we'll be back in October.